Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan, coming to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
The last couple of years have been especially hard. The narratives internationally and locally have been quite damaging, especially for trans people.
We hear from the Queensland Human Rights Commission at Brisbane Pride also.
Climate change poses a really significant risk to all Australians, and particularly those who are already marginalised and excluded from our society, and the risk of not having connections and not having support.
Climate change can have a greater impact on people with a disability, faced with higher rates of comorbidity as a direct result of rising temperatures. And later today...
Personally, it was the fulfillment of a dream, but it also enabled me to feel like I'd done something useful and valuable.
How volunteers remember the Sydney 2000 Olympics 25 years on. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, the federal government paid private law firms more than $60 million in the last financial year to fight NDIS participants appealing decisions about their care packages. This is a 60% increase from the year before, as revealed by The Guardian Australia last week, shown by figures released under Freedom of Information. The fees pay for lawyers, sometimes barristers, from some of Australia's biggest law firms to represent the NDIA against people with a disability and their families, who are appealing funding cuts received to their NDIS packages. To hear more about how harmful the appeals process can be, I spoke to Executive Manager for Spinal Life Australia, Ross Duncan.
This expenditure of $60 million over a 12-month period by the Commonwealth Government, defending basically indefensible decisions, is a disgrace. It's traumatic and anxiety-inducing for people with disability who are already living with a disability. They've already demonstrated their disability and the impact it has on their life to the NDIS, yet they have to do it again. Yeah, they can be traumatic, and they can be drawn out appeals that proceed through the administrative review tribunal process. The process itself is formal. It's independent. It's been established to revisit decisions made by the government. So the administrative review tribunal is a very good place to go, but it is traumatic, it is drawn out, and it's resulting in people having to live without equipment for a while, or for the NDIS to fund rental equipment while the person with disability is trying to justify a replacement of equipment that the NDIS has previously bought. They're going without the ability to purchase new equipment that's replacing broken equipment, or they're going without the support hours that they need, or they're going without catheters. So the disgrace is that the Commonwealth Government is spending $60 million on lawyers rather than providing 1 million hours of personal supports for people, or 5,000 beds, or 6,000 wheelchairs, or tens of thousands of assistive communication devices. Whatever is needed, the government is spending this money on lawyers, choosing to do that rather than putting it where it makes the most difference to people with disability. And the review mechanisms need to be fixed, made simpler, made faster, and resolve things without so much stress and anxiety for people with disability.
The extent in which what we've seen in these figures to which the NDIA is represented by lawyers means that these applicants often need to seek legal support to level the playing field when going up against these big private law firms. How, to your knowledge, how accessible is legal support in these cases?
It's very inaccessible. It's a great point. It's very inaccessible. The Commonwealth Government has funded advocates to a certain degree, but there's very little in the way of legal support for applicants to call on as they're going through this process, which is why they come to firms, organisations like Spinal Life Australia, that we do lay advocacy for free, or we do lay advocacy advice on the sidelines. So even though the Commonwealth has funded some national disability advocacy companies or through the National Disability Advocacy Program, they funded organisations. That funding's not enough to provide legal advice, certainly, and they're overwhelmed. The number of cases having to proceed to the Administrative Review Tribunal is higher than it's ever been, and it's totally unfair for participants because they cannot fund or afford legal advice to fight their Administrative Review Tribunal matters.
An NDIA spokesperson told The Guardian that they're seeking to resolve these external reviews or appeals as quickly and as fairly as possible. What is the accuracy in that statement, or how accurate is that?
Well, in the last 18 months, the number of matters having to proceed to the Administrative Review Tribunal to seek resolution has increased dramatically, overwhelming organisations like ours that are there to support NDIS applicants through lay advocacy services. So the number of matters is increasing. I believe the tribunal is probably overwhelmed. One of the challenges is that the NDIS earlier this year came out and said, even though you give us reports from occupational therapists and other allied health professionals and medical professionals, we do not have time to read those reports and we do not have the expertise to understand what those reports always say. Yet here we are going through the Administrative Review Tribunal when the NDIS's first point of call is you need more evidence to justify your request. Well, we've actually already provided you evidence and you haven't listened to that, and now you want us to go and pay for more evidence that you may not read or interpret the correct way either.
What do you want to see from the government on this, or what do you think the next step should be from this coming to light?
I think Senator McAllister, the Minister for the NDIS, they're undertaking some very good reforms of the NDIS to increase financial sustainability of the scheme long term, which is great news for the Australian taxpayer and great news for people with disability. We support efforts to improve the financial sustainability of the scheme. $60 million there is there for the taking in terms of reducing waste and reducing administrative burden by reducing the amount of money being funded to external lawyers to defend decisions that get overturned in the end. So we would call on the government to immediately review and improve and streamline the review process to make it so that reviews are handled faster, more simply, and in a more fair manner, not requiring the intervention of lawyers.
Ross Duncan from Spinal Life Australia there, ending that report.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
Last week, Brisbane held its 35th Pride with glitter and music celebrating and acknowledging the LGBTIQ+ community. The Queensland Human Rights Commission was part of the event and says while protecting the queer community across Australia is good, more needs to be done. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan attended the event and spoke to Manager of Engagement at Queensland Human Rights Commission, Claudia Diaz-Amayo.
Well, Pride is always a celebration, right? And Pride, I think it's about the strength of the community, the resilience of the community. The last couple of years have been especially hard. The narratives internationally and locally have been quite damaging, especially for trans people. So I think it's about remembering, you know, why the community is strong, remembering why trans people have been here for so many years and, you know, always existed. So we are here standing up with them. We're standing up as allies, and we are supporting on anything we can to the LGBTIQ+ communities.
So in terms of advocacy or, you know, the policy that you're implementing, what's the Queensland Human Rights Commission advocating for to protect, I guess, LGBTIQ+ Queenslanders or having in a better safe space?
So we have two different pieces of legislation that protects people. So in the Queensland Human Rights Act, protects people from adversarial decisions that government departments could take that will affect the rights of people. This includes, of course, people from the community, LGBTIQ plus communities. And in the Anti-Discrimination Act, we have a whole lot of protections that are also about minimizing the chances for discrimination against people on the basis of sex, gender identity, sex characteristics. So there's a whole lot of areas where intersect with the LGBTIQ plus community, and we use those acts to protect them. People can make complaints to us if they are discriminated on basis of any of those areas. That's what we do with the acts. In terms of our obligations as commission, we have obligations to promote and discuss the rights of people.
So how is the Queensland Human Rights Commission see the performance, I'm guessing, of the Queensland government in terms of on human rights at this moment?
State-wise, I guess it has been a challenging time for people, especially trans people, because the discussions and the narratives are not very supportive of their identities. We hope that government at all levels take into account the human rights of people. So we hope that they are open to listen. We hope that they enable that conversation with the community, because at the end of the day, they are representatives of the community, and the community, you know, needs to be heard. So we think that there's a space for improvement, and we will be supporting the government to have better connection with community and better understanding of the human rights of people.
Now, my last question, there's been a lot of controversy as well with an Australian Human Rights Act.
Yeah.
That it's been first, okay, we'll go ahead and then not and blah, blah, blah. This is just a political thing. How will this act, in case of being implemented, improve the lives of Australians and Queenslanders in terms of human rights?
Oh my God. The Federal Human Rights Act could fill up all those gaps that at the moment we are not able to protect. So, for example, some policies fill within spaces of federal government where we have, within our limitations of the Queensland Human Rights Act, we cannot go any further. So that's all we have. And every state has just their own acts. But what happens with all these big, you know, federal organizations? So in the case of aged care, for example, HCARE, a lot of that funding, and they are under federal government. So all those policies and all the legislation that is created on that space is not overseen by the framework of human rights.
Claudia Diaz-Amayo from the Queensland Human Rights Commission there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Armidale on 2ARM, to our listeners in Alice Springs on ACCC, and to the other side of the country on Radio Galari in Broome, Western Australia. Most Australians are living with the consequences of climate change. However, those with disability are often faced with high rates of comorbidity as a direct result of rising temperatures, according to the recently released National Adaptation Plan. As a survivor of the 2003 Canberra bushfires, Eve Brennan understands how difficult it can be to manage additional health challenges. Eve Brennan is an environmental educator living with a disability, and she spoke with Powered Media's Emma Myers about how climate change affects disability and how advocates are working on addressing these challenges.
I was in the Canberra bushfires in 2003 when I was 9, and I didn't realise at the time, but I had quite severe PTSD already from medical trauma. I'd had shingles when I was 8 from the stress of everything I'd endured in early childhood from medical trauma. And so then when the bushfires came through, it actually triggered my first ever psychosis. the stress around me of being in the bushfires and being evacuated. My family was safe and my house was safe. But the collective stress around a community surviving that meant that not only did I experience psychosis from that at the age of 9, it got missed by my teachers, by my parents. It wasn't recognized for what it was, and that resulted in a suicidal episode 6 months later. When people who are already experiencing medical trauma, who are already experiencing difficulties in surviving, experiencing climate disasters can tip people over the edge, and that's what happened to me as a child. And so I'm really passionate about preventing that from happening to other people.
But tell me a bit about your take on the new National Adaptation Plan for Climate Change.
So the National Adaptation Plan was released in conjunction with a National Risk Assessment, which, as someone who's been studying climate for over 10 years, it didn't really tell us anything we didn't already know. It just put all this information together and made it really crystal clear that climate change poses a really significant risk to all Australians, and particularly those who are already marginalised and excluded from our society, and the risk of not having connections and not having support. What I read in the risk assessment was that it's great that they're putting it on paper that we are seriously at risk for climate change. The adaptation strategy that came with that is how do we manage that? And it was great to see that they explicitly linked to the National Disability Strategy from 2021 to 2031 as part of that. It was great to see that they're explicitly acknowledging and working in disabled people to their adaptation strategy. So I'm glad that they're looking at adapting to climate change. I'm concerned that they're not mitigating it enough, that we need to do everything we can to prevent climate change before we take a reactive approach, because in their own report, they're looking at 2.7 degrees of warming. For context, the last ice age was 4 degrees difference to pre-industrial levels, and that was 12,000 years. And we are looking at 2.7 degrees in 100 years. That is a huge amount of alteration to the Earth system, and we need to be doing everything we can to stop it. Releasing the plan is great. It's great that we're acknowledging that it's a serious risk. It's not great to do that in the same week that they're expanding a Northwest gas shelf in WA and approving an extension for a coal mine. They need to do both.
Can we talk a little bit about how climate change is impacting people with disability and how they live with additional challenges?
Climate change increases the risk of all sorts of illnesses and diseases. A particular one is vulnerability to heat stress. Heat stress is a massive risk to disabled people. The likelihood of you being exposed to a natural disaster is increased, and it continues to increase under climate change. Where communities are exposed to those sorts of things, it's often disabled people that get left behind. And that means that disabled people have the risk of being left behind, and it's really important that we name that and identify it and take a proactive approach. By 2050, the risk from climate-related disasters is projected to be severe. The access people can get to healthcare facilities and to support systems and those sorts of things from the government is projected to be really disrupted within 25 years. What we also need to think about is things like crop failure in terms of both food and access to nutritious food, which is a struggle for a lot of disabled people, but also for pharmaceutical crops. Those disruptions are going to impact how people can access medicine and whether or not they can get the medicine they need. All of these things are projected to be significant risks to disabled people. In the National Adaptation Plan, disabled people are mentioned 8 times, which is better than the risk assessment. It's 72 pages long for the summary document. And so in that sense, disabled people do need explicit care and they need explicit strategies that allow for access.
Disability advocate Eve Brennan there, speaking with Powered Media's Emma Myers.
A different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
September 2000, the world turned its eyes to Sydney for one of the most memorable Olympic Games in history. But behind the athletes, the ceremonies, and the global spotlight were thousands of volunteers who helped make it all happen. The Wire's Thomas Kutis spoke with one of the volunteers from 2000, Rosemary Muller, who told us about how she got involved in volunteering for the Olympics.
When I was very young, I was a pretty good athlete. I went all through high school sort of undefeated in England. Then I came to Australia and I continued to do well until I got to university, and we just had an intra-university event and I got beaten badly, and I suddenly realised that I wasn't as good as I thought I was. But I was passionate about the Olympic Games, and in 1993, when Juan Antonio Samaranch opened that envelope and said, "And the winner is Sydney," I was coming to the end of a teaching career and I thought, gosh, I could write to them once I've got an organising committee and see if there's anything volunteers can do early on, which I did. And they explained to me they were creating a small group of pioneer volunteers, and we did all kinds of things to assist SOCOG. Things like meet and greet at the airports when delegations came in, because many big countries send an executive team to look at our training facilities, the food, the security, the hotels for their guests and so on. So I did a lot of that. I also then was trained to go out to community groups like Lions, Provis, Rotary, schools, and talk about the Games and hope that I could say something that would encourage them when we got to enrolling the big volunteer army to maybe think about doing it. So I had lots of very wonderful experiences in those 7 years.
Wow, what a wonderful story. And at least you got the opportunity to volunteer for these Olympics. Could you describe a moment during the Games that really stood out for you?
Yes, two things actually. I was very lucky that I had a hero who was a Brazilian dual gold medalist in the triple jump, and he actually spent the Games with us. He came as a mentor for the Brazil team. And on the night that Kathy Freeman ran the 400, he was invited because we introduced something called legends, and whatever final was on that night, they had a legend that had previously won a gold medal, and they were introduced to the stadium. So I was able to take him to the stadium, and I was invited into the Games family area to watch. And of course, he came out because it was a triple jump final that night. And the 400 meter representative was the great Juan Terena from Cuba, the man who used to run in long white socks. So I got to meet him, I got to meet Al Uta, and this is all before Kathy ran and won her gold medal, so that was a night for me to remember.
I'm curious to know, what did a typical day look like for you as a volunteer for those couple of weeks?
I was very lucky that we had an apartment actually at Homebush, so I could walk to work.
Oh, wow, very close.
Yes. Before the opening ceremony, we did the team welcome ceremonies. And then once the game started, our role was to look after particularly VIPs, heads of state and so forth that came to the village, conduct them around, often to take them to their team. And I remember one day in the village, I saw a very tall gentleman with two people sort of hovering beside him, looking around. I was in my uniform, so I went over and said, "Excuse me, can I help you?" The two men jumped in front and said, "This is His Majesty, the King of Norway." And I went,
"Oh, wow.
Well, welcome to Sydney Olympic Village." And then I was able to take him to where I knew the Norwegian team was. That was special.
Looking back, how do you think volunteering at the Olympics impacted you personally or professionally?
Personally, it was the fulfillment of a dream, but it also enabled me to feel like I'd done something useful and valuable. And I began to realize that our volunteers were the benchmark. I learned that this country has a great history of volunteering, you know, school sports and firefighters and surf lifesavers and all those jobs. This country wouldn't function properly without volunteers. And I realise that's part of our culture, whereas other countries, it's not.
Volunteer from the Sydney 2000 Olympics, Rosemary Muller there, speaking with The Wire's Thomas Kutis. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire has been produced today with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan. As always, thank you so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.